listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Rapid response oil well firefighting teams are gearing up for the possibility of massive oil well fires in Iraq. This according to a Houston, Texas-based oil well firefighting company, Cud Pressure Control. The Pentagon is tapping all three of the world's leading oil well firefighting companies out of the fear that Iraqi President Saddam Hussein might set explosive charges and ignite some of the 1,500 oil wells strewn throughout the country. Jackson Allers of sister station KPFT in Houston recently spoke to Jeff Miller, a spokesperson for the oil well firefighting company CUDD Pressure Control, and to Greenpeace Research Director Kurt Davies about the potential environmental disaster that could occur if the Iraqi oil wells are ignited. He files this report.
Over the past 2 months, United States intelligence sources have reported Iraqi troop movements near the country's two main oil fields, the Kirkuk oil field in the mountainous northern region, primarily a Kurdish area, and the southern oil field of Rumaila, primarily a Shi'i Muslim area. Some U.S. intelligence sources are warning against the invasion of Iraq due to potential blowback from the Arab world. Military officials are also warning about the possibility of a retaliatory response from Iraqi President Saddam Hussein if backed into a corner by U.S. military aggression. One such response, a doomsday act of defiance that would include exploding mines at oil well sites in all parts of the country. Houston, Texas-based Cud Pressure Control is one of the three oil well firefighting companies in this nation the Defense Department is expecting to help put out such fires. Cud Pressure Control was in Kuwait during the first Gulf War, and company spokesperson Jeff Miller details what the Pentagon is asking and what's at stake for the oil well firefighters.
I think they're just, at this point, just telling us to be ready and to find out what their options are as far as what type of equipment would be available. With Kuwait, it was so different because, number one, Kuwait's about the size of Harris County. So if you're talking about a relatively small country, it was flat. It was very close to the water. Getting equipment in and out of there was no problem. Getting water to use to put out the fires was no problem. The oil fields in Iraq are really spread out. I mean, Iraq's the size of California. So you've got a major section, probably 50% of the oil wells in Iraq are in the northern part, which is all mountainous. The other parts are split down near the south, which is desert, and there's some in the middle. The big fear, and there's no water except for the Tigris and the Euphrates River, and the big fear here, I think not only among the well control firefighting firms, but also among the government, is that if he decides to blow up his own wells, which indications that we've read about in the press are that he's already got these things booby-trapped and wired and ready to go, that the oil from those wells is going to flow into the Tigris and Euphrates, which is the only freshwater source in the region. And not only from a firefighting standpoint is it disastrous because it means we won't have water to put out the fires, but that provides drinking water. I mean, you're talking about major fish kills, livestock kills, crops, starvation.
Greenpeace Research Director in Washington, D.C., Kurt Davies, echoes Cud's concerns about the environmental impact it could have on the Iraqi people if the Tigris-Euphrates is contaminated.
Well, there's a couple things on water resources. That's the frightening prospect that they would not even have the water available to help put out the fires is something that I don't think we've even considered here at Greenpeace. The point about the importance of the Tigris and Euphrates, if that water supply is damaged by massive oil spill and or used to put out fires instead of flowing downstream, it affects the agricultural base of the country. It affects the entire ecological and economic stability of everyone who relies on that river throughout the country for drinking water, for use in agriculture, and all the way down to the Gulf.
U.S. military analysts say in the event that the U.S. does attack Iraq, the plan is to control the main oil fields early in the military campaign, preventing any defensive moves by Saddam Hussein, including setting fire to his oil wells. Having seen the oil well firefighter companies taking well over a year to extinguish the 600 wells that were lit in Kuwait during the first Gulf War, Greenpeace researcher Davies questions if the military plan to limit such an environmental catastrophe is actually feasible.
Yes, what we're worried about is, even in Bush's speech, the American Enterprise Institute, he expressed that they are planning to, quote, protect the natural resources of Iraq. You know, can that be done? Can they keep these fires from being lit? And will they be able to put them out once they're lit in very treacherous conditions? There's a question whether the wells will be booby-trapped in any way. I mean, it's a really big problem, aside from all the other political discussion about the war. war, the environmental impact of this war could be devastating.
Cud Pressure Control spokesperson Jeff Miller also knows that there is a job to be done if the oil wells are lit. But he admits Cud firefighters are hoping they won't have to deal with what is the potential of being an epic disaster.
I mean, this, if it happens, no matter what causes it, whether it's through military action or through just Saddam deciding that even before any military action happens that, you know, if I can't have my oil, nobody else can, and he may just blow up his wells anyway. Our position is we want to control the environmental damage as quickly as possible because, I mean, one oil well just flowing into the soil for an hour is going to cause environmental damage. But when you get 1,900 oil wells flowing about 30,000 barrels an hour into the earth, that makes Kuwait look like almost like nothing. So it's like one of our senior firefighters who was in Kuwait and will also be going there should he be required, said the other day. He said this is probably has the potential of being the worst environmental disaster the planet has ever seen. I mean, if he sets his fields on fire, even the smoke cloud, the cloud of burning hydrocarbons, would, due to prevailing winds, head towards Russia and points east of there, which would make it almost constant nighttime. It's very scary, and, you know, we're all kind of hoping that it doesn't happen.
When asked whether putting out Iraqi oil well fires would be a boon to Cud's business, Miller admitted his company's concerns were more basic.
Like I said, hopefully it won't happen. I mean, we really don't look at it from the business standpoint. We've been a successful company before Kuwait and after Kuwait, and we will continue to be. I mean, you know, without this, there's enough enough blowouts and oil well work to be done here in the States and everywhere else to keep everybody happy. And this is just something that I don't think anybody wants to see happen.
Reporting from Houston for Peace Watch, I'm Jackson Allers.
For the past 6 years, the American Gulf War Veterans Association has received numerous reports from veterans stating that U.S. forces and not members of Saddam Hussein's Republican Guard were actually the ones responsible for the setting of the oil well fires at the end of the Gulf War. Now, the fifth member of the military who says he was ordered to set the wells on fire so that Saddam Hussein would be blamed for the act has come forward to tell his story. KPFK's Joyce Riley and Dave Unclist reenacted the soldier's testimony. The man you will hear speaking is not the officer who made the statement because he fears reprisals from the government, but his statement is read verbatim.
What was the branch of service that you served in?
For different reasons, I'd rather not state that.
Fair enough. There are a lot of people afraid of retaliation from the Gulf War. Do you understand why they feel that way?
Yes, I do. I learned to do what I did in the service, to live in a different world that most people would have been led to believe only exists inside their worst nightmares.
Now, you were involved in an operation in Kuwait that really no one has heard about until this point in time. We've had 5 or 4 other reports of people similar to yourself that have brought this to our attention. You were chosen for this mission. Why do you think you were chosen for this mission?
We're all a product of our environment. As a young man, I watched different movies and television shows, and I remember thinking how incredibly cool Rambo was and things like that. There were so many times in the form of movies and commercials, televisions, that primed me to accept that to win was everything.
And so the military sort of capitalizes on that feeling.
Oh, very much so. They find a lot of times before they even get you into boot camp where they can use your personality and your morals, they capitalize on things like that and they steer you into training avenues where you would be most beneficial to them.
Let's go to the time of the mission in Kuwait. Where were you when you learned about this mission?
We had just gotten back into camp the day before on a different mission, and we were actually in our quarters resting when we were told to muster out into the briefing tent, at which point a gentleman who I had first assumed to be an American, but I was concerned because he was wearing UN uniform and insignias, he began to brief us on the operation. He pointed out 2 strategic points, and we were briefed as a group. There were probably 30 or 40 in that group. And then we were asked to leave, and our individual commanders were given the objectives for their group, at which point our individual commander briefed us on our individual objectives, and then we went and drew our gear. We were transported via armored personnel carrier close to the front, at which point I set out on foot and acted alone.
What were you told that you were going to be doing during this mission? What were you told was the purpose of this?
there was concern that America, or that the American public, might see this conflict as an unnecessary thing. And we were asked to do this, or we were ordered to do this, in order to sway public opinion, the American public opinion, and to remove any doubts whatsoever that Saddam Hussein and his regime was a terrible evil that had to be dealt with.
And what branches of the service were represented in this briefing tent?
I recognize faces from the Navy SEALs, Marine Force Recon, and Delta Force.
Now you're on your way to this mission. You have been taken by armored personnel carrier. You're dropped off to your area, and what do you do then?
Well, then we moved through the gaps in our lines where we were actually forward of the front, as a popular expression says, behind enemy lines. We traveled up. I was acting alone. My mission objective was assigned to me personally. I did not have an operative with me. I moved forward, and I carried out my mission parameters, and then I withdrew and concealed myself until such time as the front moved past me.
Okay, let me back up a second. You carried out your mission. Let's talk about that mission.
Yes.
What was your mission? What were you told that you were supposed to do?
To damage. I was given 4 Kuwaiti oil wells to damage and start a fire.
And how did you do this?
With the use of explosives and incendiaries.
How did you utilize these explosives? What were these explosives?
The explosive I used was C4. It's lightweight and it's easy to use, very safe to transport. You can take it a wellhead is nothing more than a pipe sticking out of the ground with valves. And it's not like a water well where it would have a top that you can take off. It's completely sealed due to the environmental concerns involved with crude oil. Depending on the site of the well, the valve is anywhere between 3 and 6 feet off the ground. I placed the explosive on the wellhead and the incendiary is nearby so that after the wellhead was damaged, the incendiary could light the crude oil to fire.
And did you light it yourself?
No, I actually transmitted a signal via transmitter to a central location.
Which basically told them that the well had been set?
The well had been set, and they could detonate it at their leisure.
And what did you do then?
Then I removed myself from the area. I egressed from the area and concealed myself until our units had advanced forward of me.
I don't understand. Help me understand what you mean by that.
The whole idea behind the operation was to make it look as if the Republican Guard, while they were retreating, had set the oil well fires in a panic to keep us from getting them and to villainize them. This mission would not have been achieved if our forces saw those involved were not Republican Guard.
In other words, you were in fear of your own men seeing you, basically.
That is correct, yeah.
Did you see anybody else in the oil well field at the time that you were there?
No, I did not.
So then you egressed from the area, made sure that your own men did not see you, and then the oil well fires were started?
Yes.
Did you see them start?
I actually, due to where I was concealed, I couldn't see them. But due to the nature of the operation, you could feel the explosions and you could hear the fire.
So the story that we're told, that the Republican Guard, in their retreating, they started them very hastily, that's not accurate.
That's correct, yeah.
Did you see any Republican Guard?
In the entire time that I spent in the theater of operations, I did not see one individual that wore a Republican Guard uniform.
Did you see any Iraqi troops that wore uniforms?
I saw quite a few Iraqi troops that wore uniforms.
But you saw no Republican Guard?
I saw no Republican Guard uniforms.
After this period of time, when you started the oil well fires, did you have any concerns that you had started these fires, or did you think that it was best for this country?
At the time, like I say, due to the nature of my mindset, it did not bother me.
That was your job and your mission, and you carried it out.
That is correct.
Well, I appreciate very much your being frank with us and open about this, because there are many people that are now coming forward and saying the same thing, that there were no Republican Guard anywhere around, that it was the American troops who actually started the oil well fires. I want to thank you very much. And is there anything you'd like to say in closing?
I believe it's a shame that our government is getting ready to repeat mistakes. I went over there to fight what I thought was a common enemy of the world, and I watched my friends bleed and die for this cause, not only for us to be stopped short of our objective, our final objective. I have no reason to believe that it'll be any different this time, and I understand the necessity for the loss of life to protect our country. But loss and waste are two very different things.
And why are you coming forward right now in saying this?
I feel that for us to return over there with this current administration's mindset, that history would only repeat itself.
Thank you very much, Pete. I do thank you, and we do salute you for what you are doing.
KPFK's Joyce Riley and Dave Onclist reenacting the testimony of a Gulf War veteran who claims that U.S. forces were in fact responsible for lighting the Kuwaiti oil wells at the end of the Gulf War. was Throw by the band, 1905. As we went to air today, anti-war activists from various groups in the nation's capital gathered in front of the Egyptian embassy to protest the imprisonment and torture of Egyptians who helped organize peaceful protests against the invasion of Iraq. The arrests were made in Cairo from mid-January during the lead-up to the international February 15th anti-war protests. At least 11 citizens have been tortured by tactics such as solitary confinement, repeated beatings, blindfolds, and electric shock treatment, revealed Jonathan Neal of the International Campaign Against Aggression Against Iraq. He says of special concern is an individual who recently had a major medical operation before being arrested. He is being held incommunicado and needs medications immediately, end quote. Peace Watch reporter Kareem Kathuta spoke with Suhir Morsi, a prominent Arab-American intellectual and human rights activist. Morsi describes the anti-war movement and arrest in Egypt in the context of the Egyptian realities, both on the ground and in the face of the U.S. foreign policy.
People are definitely opposed to an attack on Iraq. Not just the opposition, it is even prominent members in the ruling party who are also against this war. Many people recognize that Iraq is the first casualty, as in fact reported in a leaked document from the RAND Corporation, where Iraq is seen as the initial attack. Saudi Arabia is recognized as the strategic level. And then finally, Egypt is considered the big prize. So the people here in Egypt are concerned about Iraq, of course, stand in solidarity with the Iraqi people, but also recognize the U.S. administration strategy is one of nothing less than global domination. The Egyptian opposition actually is in a very difficult position because while we call for our right to demonstrate, which is a constitutional right, opposition to the Egyptian government is an internal matter. And the danger here is that the United States, under the pretext of bringing democracy not only to Iraq but to the entire region, has set out for regime changes not only in Iraq but elsewhere. And here is where the Egyptian people really find themselves saying that حكايه ان هو ما فيش ديمقراطيه في البلاد العربيه دي بتستعمل كزريعه للولايات المتحده to occupy Iraq. Okay, now we are against the oppression of our governments, but we are not going to stand in opposition to these governments if they are targeted for change by the United States administration. For one thing, Egypt is under martial law, has been since 1981, so there are restrictions. Of course, the U.S. put pressure, which becomes manifest in these mass arrests, especially among the Islamists. The opposition to the war may be seen as potentially a spark for riots of the type that we had back in the 70s, the bread riots and so on, because the economic situation is very, very bad. A taxi driver explained to me the situation of Egypt. He said, you know, Egypt is like a balloon. If only you have a pin, then it will burst. So here in Egypt, where we had a demonstration in front of Cairo University last Saturday, there were slogans raised in opposition to the war, but also calling for the release of the anti-war activists. I was in the UK when this statement about the incarceration was released, so I really cannot comment on whether they were actually tortured or not, but they were certainly detained, which is bad enough. But you see, you have to understand this, the pressure that the United States administration is exercising, not only on the Egyptian government, but on governments around the world. I mean, now we're in the business of arm twisting, of bribing, and so on, so that people will come around to the position of the Bush administration.
Arab activist Suhir Morsi speaking from Egypt. Thanks to Reem Kathuta, Peace Watch producer for Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C., for that segment. Former right-wing conservative media, quote, hitman, unquote, David Brock, tells all in his most recent book, Blinded by the Right, the memoir of an ex-conservative. Brock had a career that spanned two presidents, the first Bush and Bill Clinton, and worked diligently to promote and defend the policies and ideas of the ultra-conservative right. When his book, The Seduction of Hillary Rodham, he found himself out in the cold. Peace Watch spoke with Brock this week about his latest book and asked who were the young Brocks out there today.
Well, unfortunately, I mean, there are an awful lot of them. I mean, there was a whole group of younger conservative pundits, I guess, who came of age around the time I did, and after Newt Gingrich came into power in Congress, I think was really when they became to be more prominent in the media. The Ann Coulters, the Laura Ingrams, the Jonah Goldbergs of the world. And, you know, they are now, you know, a very steady presence. Some of them have their own talk radio shows. Some of them are on cable. Many of them publish books of the type that I used to publish, which are very successful because there's definitely a, you know, there's definitely a conservative niche market that, you know, I mean, the way I think it works is that there's a large constituency on the right for books and articles and talking heads and talk show hosts who tell them what they already believe, that in other words, that reinforce their own prejudice. And I don't think you have such a vigorous demand for that on the liberal side, because I think liberals tend to want to be challenged more and to be offered information from which they'll make up their own mind rather than being told what to think.
Are these subtle inaccuracies that you detect in the work of these so-called journalists on the right, or are they blatant lies? How would you describe the propaganda, quote-unquote, that you say you were responsible for?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's... I think that the conservative press operates without very much scrutiny by the rest of the press and by the rest of us. And I think that if you took the case going back to Anita Hill, I got away with an awful lot when I wrote that book. And that was 12 years ago. And I think if you look at take the past, you know, the recent conservative best-selling books, for example, if you looked at Ann Coulter's book of last year called Slander, there are entire internet sites devoted to the problems and the falsehoods and the inaccuracies in that book, and that's not just Ann Coulter. That would include, I think, the vast majority of these conservative-oriented books. It's worse when conservatives don't have to put their ideas in print. In other words, I think they're a bit more careful in print than they are on the air. Now, unfortunately, you know, there's not really a fact-checking mechanism out there for much of what goes on conservative talk radio. But I listen to a fair amount of it even still. And I think if there was a fact-checking mechanism, one would find that there's an awful lot that goes on there that's not only, you know, over the top in terms of the type of speech, the hate speech, but just that are just flatly things that are just not right, that are false. But it disappears into the ether. And so there's really, they operate, as I said, with a kind of impunity.
Are there any actual meetings or common planning strategies that you recall from the past that could explain or sort of underscore this kind of coziness between the Democrats, the right-leaning Democrats and the conservatives?
Not really between the right-leaning Democrats and the conservatives. I mean, there's a lot in my book, and this is still going on today. The book talks about the 90s, but I certainly know that it's not out of date in terms of the organizational strategies of the conservatives and how they coordinate their messages, how talking points and conservative jargon is basically invented and then propagated into the organizations. There are 80 conservative organizations that hold a meeting every Wednesday morning in Washington. And so that's how there's a certain kind of unity.
80 conservative organizations that meet in Washington?
Wednesday mornings, in Washington. And that's where things are prioritized. That's where issues are spun.
Is this one major meeting?
It is one major meeting. There's a fellow named Grover Norquist who's the head of something called Americans for Tax Reform, and he has put together this conservative coalition, and it really runs the gamut from the National Rifle Association to pro-life groups to the foreign policy hawks, and they do come together, and there is this kind of coordination, and I can see the results of that, you know, just by by reading the press and by watching television that there are certain ways of speaking that are replicated across the board. And so, you know, one of the ways they've done this is by having so many conservative outlets all saying the same thing. It tends to lead people to conclude, well, if all these people are saying the same thing, they must be onto something. And so it's kind of almost decentralized in a certain way. The messaging and the coordination comes from a central point, but then everybody goes out and does the same thing. Now, I haven't seen right-leaning Democrats in coordination with the conservatives. I really feel it's been a process, as you said, because of the superior organizational ability of the conservatives. Basically, it's just whatever you want to call it, the zeitgeist or the conventional wisdom is moved to the right, and then Democrats react to that. They're only operating in the climate that exists, in the real climate. And in this climate, it takes an awful lot of guts to dissent. And, you know, I don't know if I was in office whether I would have the guts to enter that media climate and dissent. And so that's really the very frightening aspect of what the conservatives have created. They've created this media universe, and it sets the terms. It says what's acceptable to talk about and what isn't. And then the Democrats are kind of beaten down and follow along. And, you know, it's going to take not only finding some leadership and some people who will stand up and not be worried so much about, you know, what names they're called, but I think it's going to take a lot of investment by progressives and by Democrats to building some of these institutions that will last, that will be there, that won't be so dependent on, you know, which party is in power, but can actually build a movement that can sustain itself even when, you know, when you don't have the White House. There's another reason why the press obviously doesn't have the incentive to cover the war from a more critical point of view, and that's because, you know, many leading Democrats supported the war, and so the media dynamic obviously would be somewhat different if, for example, the leading presidential candidates in the Democratic Party were against the war rather than for the war. And so that contributes to the dynamic as well, mm-hmm. and that's definitely a part of it.
David Brock, author of Blinded by the Right, The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Reem Kathuda, Dan Pavlish, and Keith Chalgian. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.